Hello, vlogging as viewers. Welcome to Foreign Entanglements. This is the Rob and Matt show. Today being the last day of 2012, whenever you may be watching this, this might be this afternoon, might be tomorrow. We're gonna talk about 2012 today. So, how you doing, Matt?
Very well. How are you, Rob?
I'm pretty good on this last day of 2012. So, without any other structure, why don't you give me all your thoughts on 2012?
All
or
of my thoughts.
One of your thoughts on 2012.
All of my thoughts on 2012. Well, considering, you know, the area of the world I focus on the most, the Middle East, there are a number of things that competing for the top spot, but I think just the general, the general transition of what people started to call the Arab Spring, I've tried to refer to as the Arab Awakening, and the way that's continued to mutate and change and made very clear to anyone who didn't know that this is going to be a long, drawn-out process, sometimes very ugly, sometimes painful, but on it goes. I think Egypt remains, for a number of reasons, sort of the linchpin here. We have the Muslim Brotherhood really coming to power, in Egypt electing its first Muslim Brotherhood president, Mohamed Morsi. And he's behaved in ways which I think are troubling. I think there are real questions about, I mean, as someone who's always said, if we are serious about promoting democracy in the Middle East, as I think we should be, though I think we can discuss what are the best ways and like what priority we put on that. As someone who said, if we are serious about democracy, we need to recognize that these religious movements, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, are going to play a part. These are very religiously conservative countries. So pretending we can just kind of keep them out of power or out of competition in democracy is a fantasy. I think those who've argued that, as I have, do have some responsibility now to say, okay, what does the last year tell us? And I think it tells us some troubling things. I think Morsi, look at, for example, the decree the day, on Thanksgiving Day, the day after he had played a major part in the ceasefire between Hamas and Gaza after the Operation Pillar of Cloud operation by Israel. He deployed that capital or used that capital very quickly to do some moves that really kind of furthered his and the Muslim Brotherhood's interest in terms of pushing the constitution through and getting to the referendum. So I think there are some very serious questions about what the next few years is going to hold, what role Islamists, whether engaging in a political process, if we want to call it democratic, it is democratic in the most basic sense in that it's majority rule, but is this just going to be...
There were votes and they were counted, yeah.
That's right. Is this just going to be an ongoing effort by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to continue to consolidate and solidify their power in such a way that prevents any real competition in the future?
Right. Well, so, I guess I saw one tweet today, which it's just a tweet, so I don't know how legitimate it is to ask you to react to it. But, and I can't remember if it was... It doesn't sound like Mark Lynch, but maybe it was something that he retweeted or something that he was reacting to. But it said 2012, the year that the Arab Spring went bad. Right. And so that doesn't sound like Mark Lynch, and so it probably wasn't. But, is that going to be the way people – and we never know right now how to interpret what just happened. But is this going to be the way that people think about 2012 – moving forward in this relationship to either the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening, however you want to characterize it?
I think it's, unfortunately it's possible, because I do think a lot of people had some illusions about how quickly this stuff was going to work itself out. I think, as someone who really was, quite moved, as I think a lot of us were, at the events in Tahrir Square and in Tunisia and elsewhere, with, people in these different Arab countries really shaking off decades and decades of authoritarianism and showing, just demonstrating on behalf of greater freedom and greater democracy. I think it's kind of like, I don't know if I'd say it's the year went bad, but it's definitely there's sort of a hangover here as people sort of realize that this stuff is very complicated and it's going to be a big fight within these countries. And there's nothing particular, it's unique in the details in that it's happening in the Middle East and there are things about these cultures that are unique, as in all cultures. But at the end of the day, it's people practicing politics, and politics, as we know, is a rough and tumble business.
Right. I wonder if, sort of trying to speak to a gestalt is never quite appropriate, because what is a gestalt? But I wonder if there
is... It's a German word, is what it is.
Well, yes, and it doesn't talk back, I think, is the problem, in terms of speaking to a gestalt. But if there is either a... And maybe it's just a misremembering, right? Maybe it's a misremembering of what the analogy that many people have made, and that seem vaguely analogous, which are the fall of the Eastern European regimes, the communist regimes in 1989. Mm-hmm. If there is a misremembering in the West of exactly how ugly a lot of that went down, right? Actually necessarily so ugly in Central Europe, but certainly in Southern Europe, certainly in the Caucasus, where this similar set of events, this collapse of all these authoritarian regimes, not only failed to produce immediate, wonderful, happy Western democracies, but in a lot of cases produced fairly nasty, horrible wars, right? The ones that we're still dealing with, right? We still haven't resolved the Georgia-Russia conflict. We still haven't resolved the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict, all of which have their source in this wave of democratization that we saw in 1989 and 1990. And so, you know, in that sense, what we're seeing now is not necessarily that different than this, you know, the previous great wave of democratization that we saw then. I don't know, though. I mean, there also doesn't seem to be any clear analogy to Syria in that sort of within that meta analogy. And it seems like when we're thinking about the Arab Spring and we're thinking about 2012, Syria is just this bleeding ulcer on the Middle East, where there seems to be nothing if not a I think if we'd had this conversation on January 1st, 2012, you know, all we could say right now, the only difference would be that, you know, it looks even less likely that Assad will survive, but the basic issues remain, you know, sort of fundamentally untouched.
No, I think there's, I mean, let's get to Syria in a minute. I wanted to step back. I think it's an excellent point when we think of, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and the transition that these countries made. I think people do tend to focus a bit more on Western Eastern Europe, if I can call it that, you know, the Czech Republic, and these other countries. But and you're quite right. I mean, I think Georgia is a great example. I would just refer back to what I think was one of my favorite of the dialogues that I've done this year was with Kerry Kavanaugh, the president of your school there at University of Kentucky. I thought it was very, very interesting. He was the ambassador to Georgia after the end of the Soviet Union, America's first ambassador to Georgia, and he had some very, very interesting things to say about how difficult that was. But a point to make, if we're going to stay for a minute on the easy cases, you know, the Western Eastern Europe cases, I think in those cases, and I've heard others say this as well, you had a situation where you had a Soviet-backed government or a Soviet puppet government, what have you, and then you had the West, and it was a fairly clear-cut, you know, menu of options. I mean, do you want freedom, blue jeans, and rock and roll, or do you want, economies don't work, cars that don't run, and jobs that don't pay you anything. And it was a pretty, you know, it was a pretty easy choice. I think what we're seeing in the Middle East is there is a third choice, and that is political Islam. You've got, you know, Western, these authoritarian governments, you've got the kind of resistance ethic coming from Iran. And now, I mean, there are, it's not all that easy to describe, but
there's an interesting parallel, right? I mean, to talk about, you know, dogs that didn't bark in 1989, right? Were you to imagine something similar, it might be sort of like a significant Orthodox revivalism or something like that in Eastern Europe, which you really did. I mean, certainly the Russian Orthodox Church has benefited from the end of the Soviet Union, but it's not a force in the same way that modern Islam is a force in the countries we're talking about in the Middle East, right? To provide this alternative model for developing the state.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point I'm making is, like, it's not a choice between Al-Qaeda or Western-backed authoritarianism. You know, it's this organic, deeply culturally rooted sense of identity that in which Islam and Arabness, or whatever you want to call it, kind of work together constitutively to create this identity, and that's what we're seeing being worked out now. So I guess that's a long-winded saying, it's more complicated.
Now, do you think that, I mean, in your view, and you suggested a little bit earlier that you think Egypt is pivotal, I mean, is Egypt really the center of gravity of the Arab awakening? I mean, if things go poorly on, and however you want to define poorly, right, either that Morsi succeeds in, attempts and succeeds in grasping dictatorial or semi-dictatorial powers, or Morsi is removed by the military, or whatever other bad option you want to think about. I mean, is this a case that's going to have then significant ripples to the other states that have been affected by the Arab awakening? And conversely, if things go well, does this sort of set an example for how the Arab awakening in other countries might play out? So I guess, how important is Egypt? How important is Morsi?
Well, I mean, I guess we can look at this two ways. The first is from the U.S. perspective, Egypt is very important. It's, since the Camp David Accord, since the Egypt-Israel peace treaty, Egypt has been kind of the United States' main interlocutor with the rest of the region in terms of, you know, security relationships, intelligence relationships. We've done so much work on all those fronts, tracking down Al-Qaeda, working with them, with other countries. And I think, so yes, from the U.S. perspective, it really will determine a lot our ability to kind of preserve a relationship with Egypt and get them to continue to do certain things for us and not do certain things for us. Now, as for the rest of the region, I think, you know, interestingly, one of the things that made Egypt so valuable to us, the Israel peace treaty also made it, you know, made other people in the region less crazy about Egypt. So, you know, and especially in the past 10 to 15 years, I think we have seen a lot of power slowly building in the Gulf states. I think Qatar is one of the big stories of this year, the way that it is really, you know, I mean, the cliche, and it's a cliche as always, because it's true, is that it's a tiny country that really is punching above its weight in terms of foreign policy. It's just for the past 15 years really been using its considerable wealth to you know, fund all kinds of groups. It's funding Islamist groups. It's hosting think tanks and universities in its country. It's really getting itself out there. And then today, this year, we saw the Emir of Qatar make the first official visit of any leader to the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip. You know, Qatar is also, along with Egypt and Turkey, you know, really, really amping up its relationship with Hamas, which I think, frankly, is a good thing, because I see that coming at the expense of Iran, and that I think that's a longer conversation. But I'm very comfortable saying that I find that, you know, I think that's positive. So yeah, I think it is important. I think, you know, even as many people in the region were not crazy about Egypt's peace treaty with Israel, I think it still does carry a lot of weight. But again, I think we are seeing, I mean, the transition that's going on in Egypt right now with the Muslim Brotherhood, the seminal political Islamist organization in the region, now having to deal with actually governing, has again made it very, you know, a very, very important player there.
Right. That makes sense to me. It seems like a compelling way of thinking about it.
Just make one last point. I mean, there. Tariq Massoud wrote a great, great piece. Tariq Massoud from Harvard wrote a great piece a few weeks ago. In the wake of Morsi's decrees and his really behaving in a much more authoritarian way, and saying, noting that the Islamism is kind of a red herring here. You know, let's look at the authoritarian behavior. How much of this can you actually attribute to political Islam? And this is something that really rang true for me, because it's something I've brought up a number of times. You know, it's like, okay, well, you look at the way Vladimir Putin behaves. Is he an Islamist? No, he's behaving this way in a kind of very ultra-nationalist. He's made increasing connections with the Russian Orthodox Church because it's politically advantageous. And what's interesting?
Right. The better metaphor there is Vladimir Putin a communist, right? And I mean, he is not in any meaningful sense of the term a communist, right?
So
his authoritarianism is not the sort of the reliving of the CPSU and the reinvention of Comintern, right? It's authentically Russian,
right?
But it has nothing to do with the ideology that has been disposed of.
And it's really interesting to me because you see Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who's been making moves very much like this over the past 2+ years. But and let's note here that he, I mean, even though I think, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is more significant to the broader region than the Da'wah Party was, I mean, this is the United States created the first Arab Islamist government in the Middle East with the creation of the Iraqi government. Granted, it's a Shia Islamist dominated government, so it has, I think, a bit less salience, but that is a matter of fact. And so it's interesting to me how few people have tended to blame Maliki's authoritarianism on his Islamism, as we are seeing done with regard to Morsi. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Right. No, I definitely understand. Right. To the extent that we even think about the authoritarianism in Iraq, and there are probably reasons why we don't talk about it as much as we talk about it in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
In general, I think it's attributed to what's the word I'm looking for? The politics of flux, right? Or the sort of the politics of chaos, right? That you have brand new institutions that are hard to hold together. And so these sorts of institutions almost inevitably produce authoritarian behavior, right? And so you make a similar argument then about, and so, you know, all this comes down to, right, is how, and I think your point is well taken, right? Even to the extent we see authoritarianism in Egypt, how much is Islamism responsible for that authoritarianism? It's
right.
Very hard from say a social science perspective.
Or is it just, as you said,
give a good answer to that.
Yeah, as you said, the actual nature of these institutions and the fact that all, if we're talking about, you know, Maliki, Erdogan in Turkey, Morsi, these are all people, and frankly, even Putin, as someone who came out of the KGB, you know, people who were part of very, you know, secretive conspiratorial organizations and have continued to behave this way once in power.
Right. Well, and there are interesting parallels to be made between, say, Turkey and Egypt, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, if you were attempting to ferret out just how much does the Islamism matter, then it's an interesting comparison, right? Because in Turkey, you do have far more robust and far more representative institutions, and you have far greater protections for individual rights and so forth. You still see some of the same behaviors from Erdogan and Morsi, but it's completely different in terms of scale, right? And so, one takeaway from that is, oh, hey, you know, these people have an authoritarian mindset, but it's also, B, institutions really matter in shaping their behavior and in shaping what they're capable of in any given time.
Right. Right, no, and I think that's quite right, but it's also, you know, it's not as if, you know, I mean, Turkey became, you know, it is where it is because of a very authoritarian secularism that was enforced under Ataturk. So it's not as if, you know, I mean, granted that you know, for as oppressive as it was, it achieved some important things, I think, in Turkey. So we should recognize that, but at the same time, it's not as if it was, you know, it's not as if, you know, Erdogan came in and started doing entirely new things that had never been done in modern Turkey.
Right, exactly. And yeah, I mean, we could certainly, there are dueling imperatives in interpreting modern day Turkey, right? The one is just to note forthrightly and understandably, and sort of with eyes open, the serious human rights problems that you're seeing in Turkey right now, and another is to compare them with what things looked like even 10 years ago, right? And often on the same issues, right? Kurdish issues, issues of the Armenian genocide, and so forth. And within that context, it becomes harder to draw a direct line between Islamism and problems of democracy. Well, if I can drag you away from the Middle East,
please do.
Yes, I mean, I guess what's been most interesting to me in 2012 has been the effort to drag American foreign policy away from the Middle East. And I mean, the pivot did not, the notion of the pivot to East Asia did not emerge in 2012, but we certainly heard a lot about it in 2012. It's become a thing that people debate and discuss. And in the national security bureaucracy, they celebrate, they decry, they explain that it can't possibly happen, that they explain that it's already happened. And I guess and this, you know, we should talk, you know, if we want to talk just a bit about the people we've had on for entertainments this year. I think that if you were to take a look at who you've had on, it's overwhelmingly been people on the Middle East, and people I've been on have overwhelmingly been Asia-Pacific types, right? Mm-hmm. And so from my perspective, one of the most exciting trends of this year is, or of 2012, was really to start working through what the implications mm-hmm. of
right.
A Pacific pivot would be, a Pacific foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Not Pacific in terms of peaceful, but Pacific in terms of deploying the weapons we have into the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, this has been, you know, just trying to figure out if there's a Pacific pivot, trying to figure out whether it's sort of genuinely possible for the United States to disentangle itself and disentangle its foreign policy mm-hmm. From the Middle East. You know,
I would say, disentangle, maybe not the word I would choose, but really kind of, mm-hmm. you know, draw down, you know, kind of, mm-hmm. I guess put it in its right perspective.
Well, yeah, it's going back to the comments about Iraq. It's interesting how little we talk about Iraq at all right now, right? I mean, that since the U.S. troop withdrawal, essentially any discussion of Iraq and Iraqi politics is something that, you know, happens only very rarely. Your news from it, somebody like me, probably comes mostly from Twitter when the sort of the latest bombing has been announced.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, maybe I'm interested in Iraq buying F-16s, or perhaps, mm-hmm. A little bit in terms of the role that Iraq has played. But Iraq, sort of our thinking about Iraq has completely fallen off, or has fallen off substantially, or seems to be public attentiveness to Iraq. And even Afghanistan, where, you know, turns out there is still a war, and turns out the United States is a party of that war.
Right.
You know, even a conversation about Afghanistan has substantially dropped off to some extent in favor of more discussion about China, more discussion about Japan, and the political problems that they currently are embroiling themselves in.
Right. I mean, I would agree that it's dropped off, but I would – would say it's dropped off because the conversation or the argument has essentially been won, as with Iraq. There is no real argument anymore. Strong majorities, you know, agree that Iraq was a bad idea and we should have gotten out there and the president did the right mm-hmm. thing. And I think mm-hmm. it's very, very similar with Afghanistan. It was the right idea. I think, you know, I haven't seen the latest polls, but I think it's like, yes, going in there after 9/11 was the right mm-hmm. thing to do to get the people who attacked us and who supported those who attacked us. But surging again was probably not mm-hmm. the best thing. In any case, our engagement there needs to end very soon.
Right. Needs to end, needs to be reduced. And so it's not part of the... Well, I guess then the question then becomes, at what point are we going to achieve salience outside of the community that's deeply interested in foreign policy and deeply interested in security policy,
mm-hmm.
is at what point, if ever, is our East Asian issues, like the Senkaku, Diaoyu dispute, or sort of things like that, going to achieve sort of similar levels of salience where, I suspect right now that were you to poll the American public on who owns Senkakus, Diaoyus, you would have, 4% China, 11% Japan, and, 73%, we don't know what that means. And that's not wholly inappropriate. But I mean, do you think we're ever going to see a pivot of American public opinion towards Asia in any sort of detail-oriented way? I mean, I suppose, if you actually started seeing Chinese fighters shooting down Japanese fighters over these islands,
right? No, it takes it takes like a Hainan Island. I mean, we all remember mm-hmm, that.
Right.
That was the heralding of the China century for the United States right there, and then it was mm-hmm, kind of bigfooted by 9/11. But yeah, unfortunately, and it's that apocryphal, it's not Ambrose Bierce, it's often attributed to him, but it's who knows who came up with it. It's an awesome quote that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. Mm-hmm. So, it takes some sort of a crisis to kind of turn Americans' intentions and say, here's this place, here's where it is on a map, and here's why it's important to you and why you should think about it. So in the absence of something like that, I don't really think that it's going to become salient for many Americans.
Right. And I suspect that is probably the case. I mean, from a more specialist-oriented point of view, there's been so much interesting going on in the region in 2012. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, especially inside China,
right.
Where you've had some of the first genuine leadership instability,
right.
Since really, I mean, I don't know, really even sort of the late Deng period. I wouldn't call what happened this year anything close to 1989, but there were periods of instability in the later Deng period.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chinese government had been very, very, sound since then. And this year there at least appeared to be some cracks emerging in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be sort of very interesting looking forward, whether this was just a hiccup in China's apparently well-ordered authoritarian succession system, or whether this was the harbinger of something more significant. Xi Jinping won't be able to hold things together, whether there was sort of more substantial support for Bo Xilai than was sort of commonly believed, whether corruption and so forth will generate additional popular discontent, or but whether there'll be broader economic problems in China that create more difficulties.
Right, and all questions that have a huge amount of import for Americans and our
right.
foreign policy and our economy.
But
again, I think it's a very, very good question. I'd love to see you explore it more. Like, what will it take to kind of clue Americans into how important this is?
Right. Another thing this sort of leadership chaos or a degree of leadership chaos in China would probably be something that would that would clue Americans in at least a little bit to what's going on there. Part of the problem with China is that since Deng, it just doesn't generate leaders who are very, how to phrase this precisely, are very charismatic, personable, or interesting, even as villains, right? I mean, you contrast this with Russia, which seems so good at generating villains, right? And not even just villains, but characters, right? I mean, Boris Yeltsin, villain or no, he's a great character,
yeah.
right? And you can even think, well, you know, who would I have him play in a movie? Or who would I have play him in a movie? Right? And
Robbie Coltrane.
Even Putin.
Come on, give it to me. Give it to me. That's good, right?
That's pretty good. That's pretty
All
good.
All right. Thank you.
Even Medvedev, perhaps just because of context, had interesting things you could say about his character and personality. And it's just so much more difficult to generate those kinds of generalizations and thoughts in terms of China's authoritarian system, perhaps because it is so right. well ordered in terms of those transitions. I mean, Deng was obviously a colorful character.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, there have not been the kind that can generate a lot of American attention.
So China, what you're saying is that China needs a leader who's more of a Bond villain to kind of
I think this needs to be – I mean, we will – I'm prepared to – be forced to endure the Xi administration, but there has to be some sort of Bond villain after that. Right? That's a straight out demand. If you want to penetrate the American market, you need a Bond villain.
All right.
So I guess
more slowly turning around in chairs and petting of cats for the Chinese leadership is what you're saying. Okay.
Precisely.
Awesome.
Precisely. But that's my megatrend for 2012.
I think those are both strong ones.
Right. I mean, and they sort of run counter to each other in an interesting way, right? I mean, that American foreign policy. I mean, we're talking about the limited attention that both the national security state and the American public have for foreign affairs, and in some sense, your and my portfolios are competing for this attention, right? Your portfolio has dominated since 2001. You wouldn't say that.
No, I would say that, but I would also, I would also say, it's not necessarily, you know, I think a way to kind of split the difference here is, you know, yes, one of the things that Iraq and even more so the Arab Awakening has, I think, made clear to a lot of American policymakers and leaders is the limits of our influence, the limits of our power, our lack of ability to really shape outcomes. Even considering how powerful the United States is,
Right.
So I think it has led to a very slow and painful and ongoing, and sure to continue to be slow and painful, recalculation of where to invest our energy and resources, considering the costs and possible benefits.
It is interesting, though, that many of the arguments that play out in the Middle East have sort of very close the same people who worry tremendously about Iranian nuclear proliferation and worry tremendously about Iranian ballistic missiles also worry tremendously about North Korean ballistic missiles, right? And the same people who think that we should blow up the Iranian nuclear program and we should blow up Iranian ballistic missiles also think that it's obviously such a good idea to blow up North Korean ballistic missiles, or not even North Korean ballistic missiles, but North Korean. This last one was legitimately a satellite launch, and if we'd blown it up on the launch pad, it would have been an act of war. Mm-hmm. But some people thought that this was a fabulous idea, and these are, we won't mention Max Boot by name, but if you were thinking about Max Boot, then I don't think you would be wrong. Some of these are the same people who've made these arguments very consistently, and it doesn't seem to matter region to region, right, that the arguments are just sort of fill in and are, in some sense, a reaction to what you just described, or intended to push back against what you just described, the notion that the United States has limited power, right, that even as the most powerful state in the system, the United States can't do everything that it wants, any time that it wants, and so forth.
Right. No, and I think actually this is a good segue into the Chuck Hagel issue.
Okay, so what are your top five United States cabinet position battles for this year? And you can stop after one, or maybe two if you want to do two.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm happy to stay with one. I mean, I don't even know. I mean, it's amazing how much time people have spent arguing about Chuck Hagel as he's not even been nominated. And, I'm hearing conflicting things. I'd say about a week and a half ago, I would have said that it was not going to happen, but we're hearing, as of yesterday, we're hearing different things, people saying that the administration is making calls, that the nomination is going to happen, so I don't really know what to think. I will join.
Did you read David Greenberg's article in the New York Times, or the New Republic today? Sort of a classic New Republic article.
Oh, no. When you say classic New Republic, that puts me ill at ease. What did he say?
Oh, well, I mean, he denounced liberals for, sort of not really understanding foreign policy since Iraq and how desperately wrong Chuck Hagel was for this job and that, liberals who think he's a good idea are. I mean, David Greenberg once called me a commie simp for suggesting that Georgia may have had some responsibility in the 2008 war, so I have a little brief for him. But it was a classic, the New Republic concern troll. The liberal foreign policy articles. Why can't you people understand how horrible Chuck Hagel is for America? Kind of articles. So.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I like a lot of. I think first of all, okay, Chuck Hagel got, and I think Michael Hirsch really nailed this. He said Chuck Hagel got the war on terror right. And there's a lot of, even though he voted for the Iraq War, he was, and I noted this in my own piece in the American Prospect. He wasn't one of these people who jumped onto the incompetence dodge, who was like, oh, it was a great idea, we just screwed it up in execution. He was someone who went further and said, no, this was a strategic blunder that has undercut our power and influence and empowered our enemies at our expense. And he got the broader questions, I think, of the war on terror correct, that in creating this vast global conflict, we were aggregating our enemies where we should have been disaggregating them. But after having said that, it's like, listen, I just want to have a discussion, an actual discussion, okay, what he brings and does not bring to the position. And I think so many of us who reject these ridiculous accusations, obviously this anti-Semitism accusations are ridiculous and reckless, but, we're put in a position of being, just defending him against these sorts of smears, but saying, okay, let's clear this junk away to have an actual discussion of whether he's got the administrative chops to do what needs to be done as the Secretary of Defense, considering the budget cuts that need to be done. Let's actually have that important discussion and not this kind of dumb discussion, over whether he loves Israel enough.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, what do you think of the critique? And this emerges, not from the Republican side, but from the Democratic side. And I'm curious how sensitive you are to this, given sort of where you are, mm-hmm. And where you are sort of in the progressive universe. Mm-hmm. The argument that it's simply a mistake for Democratic presidents to, whatever their individual merits, to continue to appoint Republicans to the Department of Defense, right? That even though sort of every time you can assemble a logic, and I think the logic for Chuck Hagel is pretty strong, mm-hmm. But that as a general rule, we shouldn't be thinking in these terms. We should be thinking sort of Michelle Flournoy or Ashley mm-hmm. Carter or whoever else, just by virtue that they're Democrats, and Democratic presidents should appoint the Democratic people to the Department of Defense.
I mean, I think there's something to that, but I think I was much more I was much more sympathetic to that, say, 5 years ago, or even more when there was still a serious national security gap. I think by all the evidence we have shows that President Obama has closed that gap and, in fact, is now right. seen as much stronger on national security than the Republicans. So I think that becomes less salient. And I also think it becomes less salient because you actually had a Democrat doing, you know, as the Secretary of Defense after Gates, you had Panetta in there for a while. So it's not like he just right. stayed with Republicans. We've had a Democratic Secretary of Defense. So it's like, okay, why do you say that? Why do people make that criticism? It's like, well, because the Democrats need to close the national security gap. That gap has been closed. So I'm right. a bit more comfortable with appointing someone like Chuck Hagel, who, you know, I there's things I like about Flournoy as well. But honestly, when I look at Chuck Hagel, I see him as a more progressive choice from what I know about his general view about the way America should approach the war on terror. And I don't want to go too far because, I mean, as I said, there are things I like very much about Michelle Flournoy. I think she's been a very strong advocate for this administration and for some of the things this administration has done right, in my view.
Right. Right. I mean, the argument would be that Chuck Hagel is as progressive or more progressive on the things that are going to matter in DOD and that the areas in which he obviously is considerably less progressive than your median Democrat or Michelle Flournoy just aren't really relevant for this job, right? I mean, there may be some aspects of them which are relevant for this job.
Yeah, I'm not.
I mean, there are abortion issues, women's issues. Mm-hmm. There right. are there continue to be the fallout of the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. All right. of these are relevant for.
I totally agree. I'm not. I totally disagree with those who say that the abortion issue and the gay rights issue are not relevant. I think they are important questions. Mm-hmm. As a progressive, they are issues that are important to me, and I think that they should be discussed mm-hmm. in hearings. I think that is the place where he has an opportunity to describe his views, how his views have changed, and I think they are totally relevant. Maybe they're not the number one and number two things he's going to be dealing with, but they are issues he's going to have to confront as Secretary of Defense. So yes, absolutely should be discussed.
Right. I mean, I want Hagel to be nominated, if only because I think it will generate a very interesting set of floor debates over his nomination.
Right. I totally agree.
And in particular, as it will force Republicans to bring to fore and to make explicit the arguments that are sort of being made implicitly right. and quietly by people who aren't Senate Republicans right now, that, you know, that he's anti-Israel, that there are these other problems. And it will be much more compelling to see it will be very interesting to see to what extent major Republicans are willing to own those arguments
right.
About someone who was, you know, just in the Senate on their own side just a few years ago mm-hmm. In an actual war fight. And, right. and I'll be very curious to whether that happens. And so, I would also say, you know, I mean, I think Chuck Hagel would be good for the job. I think he has the right enemies. Mm-hmm. I think that... there are other choices who would be nearly as good and perhaps better on some elements, but the Chuck Hagel is an entirely reasonable choice. Now, whether that will happen is an entirely different question, right?
Right.
It'd be interesting to play out.
But I think your point, I want to stay on this for a minute, I think your point about the discussions mm-hmm. it would give rise to, not only on the floor, but also, you know, surrounding that in the broader mm-hmm. foreign policy discussion, I think are very important. And I think in my prospect piece on Friday, I noted, I think some of these attacks seem to me an effort by the neoconservatives to avoid that very discussion. Right. Having never really confronted their completely getting Iraq wrong, having right. never really confronted the complete collapse of their basic, you know, theories about how the world works with regard to Iraq and their Middle East policies, I think they don't want, you know, having Hegel explain his views would force them to confront that in a way I think they really, really have tried to avoid. And I right. think this is why we've seen a greater focus on the Israel issue, because right. it's a relationship that continues to enjoy very strong support among the American people. So they've kind of chosen this one issue of theirs that Americans support.
Right. Although, what we find out, right? To what extent does this sort of broader American support for Israel, can it be defined in the same terms as sort of neoconservative support?
Right.
Right.
I mean, right.
Where do those cohere yes. and where do they cease
yes.
being? Yeah.
Yes. I think that it's a really important question.
Right. I mean, neoconservatives may have lost their grip on reality, but they retain a very strong grip over the sort of the central organs of Republican foreign policy
right.
making.
Right.
And it's probably the latter matters much more than the former for mm-hmm. For thinking about sectarians. Just
right.
briefly, what do you think about John Kerry as sex state? I mean, let me frame it this way. Is it possible that in this day and age we can finally say that a white man from Massachusetts, can he handle the job as Secretary of State? It's been, have we reached that point in our
No, I'm glad to see this glass ceiling broken at long last. I think, yes. you know, it's our time as white men, Rob. it's been a long time coming. But, you know, here we are.
Right. I mean, do you have any more substantive thoughts about Kerry as sex state? I mean, there seems to be no reason to think he'll do the job badly that I've seen so far. But
no, I really support it, so I'm happy about it. I don't really have much deeper than that to say.
Right. I mean, that seems to be pretty much everyone's mm-hmm. reaction that he's going to sail through. That you know, potentially Scott Brown might be a senator again. Exciting, but what are you going to do? So let's move away from – well, let's partially move away from this talk about politics. And because every sort of year-end wrap-up, we have to talk a little bit about culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my top five movies
okay.
are the Avengers, Lincoln, The Hobbit, Dark Knight Rises,
mm-hmm.
and let's see. What was the other one? Now it's my mind. Oh, Skyfall. And the reason those are my top five movies is because that's the only five movies I've said. And you shouldn't list those in order, right? That's not in order. I haven't even thought about an order. I guess what did you think of the movie scene this year? And in particular, have you seen Lincoln?
I have not yet, unfortunately. It's the next
one. That would be a really interesting conversation.
Right, no, I it's the next one on my wife and I's list. But as you know, with two young children of your own, those are precious, precious hours where you get to go and see movies. Although I did make it out to see Django Unchained last night, which I thought was awesome.
Really? Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to that.
No, it is. It's just great. So I look mm-hmm. forward to maybe chatting with you either offline or online after you get a chance to see it as another Tarantino fan. I know you are.
Right.
But I think I think the only movie we share is Dark Knight Rises, and I think that mm-hmm. just made. I think I saw more than five. I may have seen as many as 10 movies this year, which is crazy. I know,
right.
but or maybe not that many. But that just made my top five. I didn't like it as much as The Dark Knight. I thought it was good. I love Tom Hardy, but again, I had issues with his. With the way they treated his voice in there behind that mask,
right?
But I know I mean, hugely impressive.
About Tom Hardy, he generated as much charisma as you could have possibly had from that getup, right? There was as much personality there as you could imagine.
Yeah.
And you know, he did a good job with what he was offered.
Right. No, and I think it was a very, very, very good way to end that trilogy. A hugely impressive mm-hmm. achievement of those three movies by Christopher Nolan. In every respect. So, I mean, in my top five, along with that, would be Looper, which I thought was a fantastic sci-fi movie. Did you see that one?
No, I did not see that one.
Yeah, absolutely. You should definitely check it out. I mean, did you see Gattaca?
I did see Gattaca,
Gattaca
yes.
with Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke. It reminded me of Gattaca in
Right,
a bit of
and Jude Law. Jude Law was in that too.
Jude Law, exactly. But it reminded me of
And
Gattaca.
Gore Vidal too.
Gore Vidal, yes. It reminded me of that in that they used a fairly small budget and very, very subtle touches to create this future world, like the sounds that cars make, the sounds that gadgets make. But yeah, really good science fiction movie. Django Unchained, definitely in my top ones. Moonrise Kingdom, the latest Wes Anderson.
Oh, I really wanted to see that.
I really enjoyed. And then Argo, Ben
Oh, I
Affleck,
really wanted to see
who
that.
continues to amaze me in that he has become just a really, really great director. And I think Argo is just fantastic.
No, I missed Argo. We had really wanted to see that, and there was just no chance. But no, yeah, that had been one of my priorities that I failed at this year. Yeah, I mean, sort of in I'm not. There has been, and it's interesting that one of us has seen one of the movies and one of us has seen the other. There seem to be some productive comparisons that people are making between Lincoln and Django Unchained. And yeah, I mean, I. And this one, I'm a Tarantino fan, so it's considered quite likely I will prefer Django to Lincoln. What I will say about Lincoln is that if you like, and there is much to be said for this kind of filmmaking, right, where essentially you put together an event picture, you have every single role in it staffed by some major star. And you make it as where the actors almost self-consciously sort of approaching this what they do in terms of everything I do is extraordinarily important. And Spielberg is not bad at making those kinds of movies. I would say that some of his best movies actually vary from that a little bit, right? I mean, I think that some of the best parts, for example, of Saving Private Ryan are almost offhand. Things that happen to one of my favorite Spielberg movies, which is The Duel, is a movie about sort of events which in and of themselves are almost trivial, but that are obviously very important for the participants. But this is a major event film of the sort that we sort of remember from the 1960s and the 1950s. And within that context, it's actually quite good. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is fabulous. Some of the other actors are quite good. One of my favorite scenes from it, and if when and if you see it, be very interesting what you think of it. But it certainly speaks to a lot of what we talk about right now, in terms of presidential politics, is when Lincoln describes the powers that he has essentially taken upon himself without any kind of legal or normative structure, right? That in creating war powers for himself, he had virtually no template with which to draw upon. That the Mexican War template was insufficient. That Madison during the War of 1812 had simply been an insufficient war president for a variety of reasons. And so Lincoln was essentially on uncharted ground in terms of defining powers of the presidency, which I think is very interesting in context of thinking about the way that presidential power in foreign policy has developed during the war on terror, where sort of much of what we saw during the Bush administration, when we sort of get past how what awful mistakes they may have made along the way, at the same time you have people trying to figure out what the office can actually do, maybe coming to the wrong answers, and the Obama administration comes to more defensible, potentially still wrong answers about what to do, but trying to work through uncharted territory, uncharted legal and normative territory. And that particular speech in the context of Lincoln, I thought was very interesting. And maybe the only part of Lincoln that really has a lot of important implications for how we think about politics today. But I'm sure, I don't know how many answers Daniel Day-Lewis has. He'll probably get like four for this, but But anyway, yeah, no, it was solid enough. You enjoy it. If you
want. No, I look forward
but
to seeing
yes,
it.
Django.
One hard to make a segue from that into Django, but I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they deal with the central issue of slavery from different, very mm-hmm. different angles, but I would say very briefly that one of the things that's always I've always loved about Tarantino's films is the way that he spends quite a bit of time in his movies with little, like, long-winded disquisitions about social conventions, like the mm-hmm. argument about tipping in Reservoir Dogs,
right.
the discussion
right.
about foot massage in Pulp Fiction, what it means, right. what it doesn't mean. In Django, there is a hilarious scene with Don Johnson. I mean, hilarious, but darkly hilarious, obviously. Don Johnson, mm-hmm. as a plantation owner, explaining to his slaves how they should relate to Django as a freed slave. That is just, you know, thinking about it a day after having seen it is really just, I mean, this is Tarantino really pushing himself and applying his talents, I think, for dialogue to something that is, I was really impressed at that he undertook something like this. So I'll just leave it there.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully I'll see it. Just really quickly, do you want to toss out, you know, I don't listen to music that has happened in the last 10 years, but do you want to throw out, like, you know, maybe a top five of things you were listening to and that people should listen to?
Oh, off the top of my head, I would just say I was a big fan of Pepe Deluxe's record, Queen of the Wave. Mm-hmm. It's 60s psychedelic surf electronic music. People can get their head around that. King Tough, another great record that started off as an awesome, you know, garage rock record and then transitioned pretty slyly into being a great pop record. Another is Screaming Females, which our friend Spencer Ackerman turned me on to, which I will be eternally grateful. Let's see, what else? Those were kind of the big ones that I listened to this year. I'm sure I'm forgetting a few. But, yeah. So I'll just stick with those three. Those are my top three.
All right. What else to say, you know, about things that were interesting in 2012? It was a year of sports heartbreak for me.
Yeah.
As my beloved Reds lost after leaping out to a tremendous lead in the National League Divisional Series. My beloved Ducks lost just a ridiculous game to Stanford and therefore aren't playing for the national championship. The University of Kentucky did win the basketball national championship. And so being in a city, this is the first time I'd been in a championship city, and Lexington takes its basketball championships very, very seriously. And so that was a lot of fun. It was being here in Lexington as we celebrated a national championship in NCAA basketball. So, but yeah, other than that, 2012, goodbye. I guess we'll go into 2013 now. Could skip it over maybe and try 2014. I don't know if that's ever been done, but.
Not a lot of movies have predicted what life would be like in 2013. And
Are there some?
I don't know, but I will say once again that where's my freaking flying car, scientists?
Right, well, and you my know? Hoverboard, too. I mean, that's bliss. Yeah,
hoverboard.
We don't have that much time.
No flying car, no lightsaber. Why? Because scientists are lazy. So.
Right. No, scientists and engineers. Let's just not put it on
you
the
know,
side.
They just, they've basically given up.
All right, well, everyone, we hope you had a lovely 2012. We hope if you get to watch this before New Year's that you stay safe. And we hope if you watch this tomorrow after New Year's that you stayed safe. Although I guess if you're alive, you stayed safe enough. But thank you for watching A Year of Foreign Entanglement.
Yes, thanks everyone for watching and for commenting.
And for commenting, absolutely. We will have new episodes soon.
All right. Happy New Year, Rob.
All right. You too, Matt.